Hi, I'm Dr. Stan Steindl. Welcome to Compassion in a T-shirt. Today I'll be speaking with Graham Music, psychotherapist, supervisor, trainer, lecturer, and author. He currently works in private practice and with the NHS, and was with the Tavistock and Portman clinics for over 15 years. He teaches and lectures far and wide, and some of his books have gone through several editions. We talk about the Tavistock Clinic and some of Graham's history as a psychotherapist, and he gives us a bit of a précis of his early book, Nurturing Natures. And we dive more deeply into his latest new book, Respark, Igniting Hope and Joy After Trauma and Depression. What is spark? What is despark? What is resparking? And so I bring you Graham Music. But yeah, Graham Music, great to get a chance to speak with you. And I was doing a little bit of research about you and your background, of course. Welcome to Compassion in a T-shirt.
Great to be here. Nice to speak to you, Stan.
You worked for a long time, actually, with the Tavistock Clinic in London.
Yeah.
And I wondered whether we could actually start there a little bit, perhaps what is the Tavistock Clinic story, but maybe also what is the Graham Music at Tavistock, you know, story as well. What's that story?
Well, obviously there was quite a story before the Tavistock, but I'm happy to talk about the Tavistock as an institution, also what I did there. And so the Tavistock Clinic is basically in the British NHS, and it's primarily a mental health trust, and it probably half its time is divided between teaching on a range of different courses, primarily for people who are doing other work like social workers, teachers, but also psychotherapy and psychiatry and educational psychology and psychology trainings, and also has a range of services. It's become notorious in the last couple of years because of all the issues around the gender services, which gave it a rather bad reputation in the UK. I'm not sure if that reached Oz or not in terms of lots and lots of controversy, but actually probably what it's best known for and some of the things that I feel most proud of is the fact that attachment theory developed at the Tavistock. John Bowlby developed this extraordinary body of thinking and kickstarted something which has taken off across the world in terms of understanding children's development and parenting and a whole range of different things. And of course, actually, he also started the child psychotherapy training at Tavistock alongside other people, but he wasn't somebody who easily fitted into that system. And so interesting, the Tavistock is a place where the child psychotherapy training I did, which is my second psychotherapy training, is much more of a traditional psychoanalytic, especially Kleinian influence training. And John Bowlby's work was seen as having too much focus on the external world and on behaviours and not enough attention on the inner world and on the unconscious, interestingly. And I think that changed, and maybe we'll get to talk about that in terms of how attachment theory developed. But in terms of Bowlby's, he spent a lot of time doing extraordinary research, being asked to give speeches and talks to the World Health Organization and internationally and nationally, and hardly anybody really took him seriously at the Tavistock, which is a terrible tragedy for me. And one of the things I think is fantastic about the Tavistock historically is that it's been a place of innovation. So there's been extraordinary people that often get forgotten. Like, I don't know if you've ever heard of a guy called Ian Suttie. He was an amazing guy who did this extraordinary critique of Freud in the 1920s, suggesting that the primary drive of the infant is not aggression or food or sex, but love. And in a way, he was a precursor of Bowlby and attachment theory. He wrote this extraordinary book called The Origins of Love and Hate in about 1920 or something, promptly died at a terribly young age of 37. And he's kind of got forgotten at the Tavistock. But I think the Tavistock was a place of radical pioneering ideas once upon a time. And that was part of what I wanted to be part of.
Yeah, I mean, it's still radical pioneering ideas, I guess, in some ways. I suppose in every era, perhaps they were kind of at the sharp end of what was new and what was being developed, and perhaps
even those early people that you're mentioning, they probably copped a bit of flak too, maybe, I don't know, by some of their ideas just being kind of radical.
I think they did, and there were an extraordinary bunch of people. Michael Barlint was there, and Wilfred Bion, probably the most famous person in the psychoanalytic world, was there, you know, eating in the olden days, the top floor where there's now a big lecture theatre, and the whole top floor was the canteen run by a kind of like an army chef who cooked terrible food. And it was like you'd go in there and you'd get these extraordinary greats like Wilfred Bion and Michael Barlint and extraordinary child psychotherapists eating the most terrible lumpy custard and overboiled cabbage together. And that was what it was like.
It's
But yeah, but it
quite
was a
the
place. So
picture.
yeah, it was a great, and actually one of the great things that came out of there, which I think is still really, really a fantastic thing to do, and I developed a few myself there over the years, is this idea of you develop a workshop where you have an idea you want to think about. It could be compassion. I did one on body states and trauma, or one on the implications of clinical implications of neuroscience and attachment theory. And you get a bunch of staff together and you get a bunch of trainees together and you put them in a room for an hour a week and you just discuss the ideas based around clinical work. And you don't know what's going to come up and you can't plan for it. And whoosh. And lots of the actually the best books that have come out of Tavistock have come out of an eating disorder workshop or an autism workshop or, you know, refugee workshop or an adolescent workshop or all of these things. They were absolutely brand new in their time, infant mental health workshop. These things didn't exist before these workshops. And then suddenly they became these things that we could, these areas that we could really think deeply and widely about. And that's what I'm passionate about, I think.
Yeah, what an amazing kind of environment for, sort of passionate minds to really throw
Yes.
ideas around and probably disagree, but also maybe find common ground and eventually hone something, hone something really special out of conversation. And I mean,
Yeah.
where do we get to sort of do that so much anymore? It's actually unique in a way.
I think it is. Maybe we should do it more, Stan, and we
We
should get.
do.
And
We
I
need
think
to.
it's interesting because what happens is things get institutionalized, bureaucratized. I don't know if you remember the work of Max Weber, the sociologist. Things get kind of bureaucratized and a bit rigid, and then this is
Yes.
the idea. And I think there's a danger, whether it's CFT or psychoanalysis or developmentally informed psychotherapy or whatever it is, there's always a danger that things become rigid and this is the way we think now, as opposed to, and often radical ideas get, you know, they then get pushed into tram lines. And I think what you
Yes.
said, so interesting and important in terms of compassion-focused therapy as well, is that it's passion. And the passion bit of compassion, I think, is really, really crucial.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's funny, isn't it? Often founders are radical thinkers, free thinkers, coming up with new ideas, and then you have the first generation of followers and then the second generation of followers, and gradually it gets dogmatized or
Yes.
that sort of thing. And it's an interesting way that humans do it. So how long has the Tavistock Clinic been in existence?
Well, I don't know exactly. It's all on the website if anybody wants to look, but I suspect about the best part of 80 to 100 years now. And a lot of the interesting work at the beginning, I mean, it moved to its current location from somewhere near Tavistock Square, which is in central London, Bloomsbury, the site of, you know, the Bloomsbury Group and all kinds of interesting things, and then moved to Swiss Cottage, which was the site of where a lot of Jewish refugees were living. And it was 200 yards away from the Anna Freud Centre, even though Anna Freud and Melanie Klein practically never spoke to each other. And there was historical rivalry between all these institutions, which is a whole other maybe rabbit hole we don't want to go down. But there was a kind of a history of emigres, many of whom were Jewish, not all, who were trained by Freud or his successors or had analysis with some of his analysts, you know, people who he trained, and that a lot of them settled in that part of the world. But some of the most interesting stuff came out before the Second World War, and it was people like Bion's work on what was called shell shock at the time, and developing ways of working with groups, understanding unconscious processes in groups, which was so fascinating, so interesting. So yeah, it's that thing of like these new. The metaphor I quite often like to use is of if you're gonna make a piece of glass, you've gotta blow it, you've gotta heat it up to white hot temperature so it's molten and it's pliable and flexible, and then you can place it into a shape. But actually, if it's too rigid, then it loses its You know, it might be a good, beautiful thing, but it might lose its capacity to change and shift. And that's, I think, what we don't want with any of our forms of therapy, or actually any of the ways we live our lives.
Yes, you mentioned that there was a lot for you before Tavistock as well, and so I was curious about that as a psychotherapist. I mean, I know you've had training spanning sort of humanistic and psychoanalytic, you mentioned, but also everything from compassion focused therapy to mindfulness. And how have you done that? What's your approach, and how have you kind of integrated all of these different approaches?
I struggle to stay, I struggle to believe that there's only one way of seeing the world. My entree into therapy was quite late, although I had my first therapy in my early 20s. And I did all kinds of things, worked with as a residential social worker with very disturbed children, and then I did, had various jobs like that, worked in housing with people who are struggling. And then I had a kind of late adolescent escape. And I think because I was probably a fragile, vulnerable young man who didn't think that I could forge a career in that world successfully, because I felt I was too probably insecure and neurotic and not well enough. And so I became an antique dealer for 6 or 7 years. But I was one of those antique dealers, quite a rare thing. I used to travel around the country, like go to places like the North of England, like Oldham or Dewsbury, and I would go to the markets at 6, 7 in the morning and do my buying and selling. And then I'd be sitting in the cafe eating what they do in Yorkshire, like chip butties, and I'd be reading Freud or Jung. So it was always like part of my, I was always passionate about and interested in psychotherapy. And then I had a kind of bit of a breakdown in my late 20s, and I went back into therapy, but I was in therapy in my early 20s. And then I studied some art therapy, thought this was really interesting, studied some loads of psychodrama. I thought, blimey, this was mind-blowing stuff. Did an introductory course, something called the Institute of Psychotherapy and Social Studies, which actually was R.D. Lang's, one of the founders of that place. And incidentally, R.D. Lang is another person who was at the Tavistock that everybody forgets about. And extraordinary thinker. And I remember very well sitting in a group at IPSS, and there was psychoanalytic stuff and humanistic integrative stuff, and the humanistic experiential stuff. I was sitting there thinking, this is scaring me witless. I could have said a worse word there. And I was really terrified of being having to talk about feelings, showing my feelings, any of that stuff. And I knew I could do the intellectual stuff and the cognitive stuff and the psychoanalytic theory. So I decided then to do a humanistic integrative training to work with adults, which included body work, included had quite a lot of psychodynamic stuff as well, but included body work, included gestalt, included a whole range of different things where I could integrate the stuff I'd learned about the body and about the psychodrama, the active thing. And actually, I did it in order for me to see if I could become a slightly more rounded human being, actually. So it was less about me becoming a therapist, probably. It was more for myself. And during all that time, I was doing play therapy with children and doing various forms of therapy. And there's a nice, interesting story about the play therapy, which was I started working with this voluntary, you could now call it a voluntary organization or something, but actually, it was a slightly crazy old lady called Rachel Pinney, who was a complete genius as well, who lived in a council flat. She was a sergeant major's daughter who lived in a council flat, kind of in one of the poorest parts of Islington. And her flat, she turned into a play therapy centre. And she had very strict ideas about you had to show empathy and you had to follow and you couldn't put your own stuff into the room. And kids got better. And there was no checks in those days. I mean, it could have been anybody. I think she was quite strict in how she checked people, but there was no like any of the things that you probably have in Australia that we have now to do with government checks about whether there's been any criminal act. You could just walk in there and within 3 or 4 weeks you were seeing kids and they got better. It was amazing. So I was learning all that, and then I did this integrative humanistic training, and I think I did become a more rounded human being at that point and felt a bit braver, dare to speak up in groups and become and I think my learning took on quite a lot of depth, but I felt it wasn't enough. So I have always had an adult psychotherapy practice since then. So that's over 30, 35 years now. And then I decided that I wanted to work in the public sector, and I wanted to work with people who couldn't afford to pay, and I wanted to work with people who have on the wrong end of suffering maltreatment. And that if I trained as a child and adolescent psychotherapist in at the Tavistock in the NHS, I'd be able to do that as well. So that was my next step. And I think I've always worked with people who've suffered trauma and maltreatment. It's always been my one of the things that I suppose I've fallen into it. And I feel I understand people like that, how their lives have formed, how their personalities have formed, how things have fallen in or out of place because of their experiences. And so that's always been my passion, my interest. And one of the things I got at the Tavistock was that I could integrate some of my early learnings and integrate stuff from neuroscience. Neuroscience was just coming in. It was so interesting. So I remember the first talk I heard from, I think it was Mary Sue Moore, who's now a great friend. She lives in Boulder, Colorado. This stuff that she was talking about in relation to Alan Shore and Bruce Perry that everybody knows now. Did you know the brain can change according to experience? Wow. And so there was that, and there was the bulby stuff, and people were just beginning to integrate that stuff. And I was trying to integrate it for myself in the Tavistock, which was still primarily psychoanalytic. And actually, I felt a bit ashamed of all the old stuff, the humanistic stuff, the body stuff. It was like you weren't allowed to talk about that there. So it's taken me quite a long time over the years to be able to integrate and bring those things back together. And it's been quite, and I think trauma has been the thing that does that. And I think it's rather like CFT, really. It's you can't work with somebody who's experienced trauma unless you pay attention to their body states and your own body states and understand the ramifications of those early experiences and how they show up in all kinds of different ways, but primarily within body states.
Yes, you had both the sort of the intellectual kind of hunger for it, by the sounds of it. You sort of enjoyed the learning that literally just sort of, but also, yeah, there was a part of you that was nervous or feeling worried. Can I really do this? Am I a whole person that can bring myself to this work? And so that sort of motivated you as well. You mentioned R.D. Lang there. Did he sort of share sort of his lived experience kind of things? And did that influence you at hearing someone like that talk about his own experiences?
I never heard him at the Tavistock. He trained long before. So he did a psychiatric last bit of training at the Tavistock, and then he went off and did those extraordinary things. And he was a maverick and a controversial figure and did all kinds of things. And obviously I've heard him speak over the years, and I've seen him on video and read a lot of his work. In fact, when I was at university in the late 70s, mid to late 70s, it was every course had R.D. Lang books on them. I think it didn't matter if you're studying English or sociology or psychology or philosophy or anything. No one reads him now, I think. But he had extraordinary insights. And so I was very influenced by him. Actually, his own personal revelations, I don't think they were that apparent in his work until later. Although I don't know if you've ever heard In the Psychiatrist's Chair by who is it, Anthony? I've forgotten his name. It was a BBC program, and there's an extraordinary interview with him about his early childhood, which is really quite chilling. Actually, made sense of how he became who he was. But actually, it's not something that gets done at the Tavistock, really, in terms of if people write, they write about the work. It's still more one person than two or three person psychology in terms of the way things are thought about. So you describe a bit of theory, describe the work with the patient, and your own stuff. You might describe your counter transference, at least insofar as it might be something that's being evoked by the patient. But you don't talk about your own stuff, really. It's not normally done. And so I had to, so it felt a bit risky when I started doing that.
Yes, and it's amazing how there's a kind of a full circle there that sort of years ago you were very interested in the humanistic, but also the body-based stuff, the somatic work, and then kind of felt like you had to be a bit secret about that or something during some of those years at the Tavistock. And yet it's all come back. And actually your first book, Nurturing Natures, which I think has now come out with a second edition. Is that out yet or coming out?
I hate to say it, Stan, but it's the third edition and it came out.
Third edition, my apologies. The second edition was 2016, I think.
Yeah. So the third edition came out two or three weeks ago.
Two or three weeks ago.
Yeah, maybe we can put some links on if anybody's interested. Yeah. So actually, my first book was a very short book called Affect and Emotion, which I republished that last year and changed it and amended it. And that was quite early on. That was a small little introduction to ideas about affect and emotion from a psychoanalytic perspective, primarily. And then, but my first major thing, and it really was a labor of love, was Nurturing Natures.
Yeah,
And
so this is
yeah.
where you really kind of integrated everything and was understanding children's development really from the perspective of attachment theory and neuroscience and developmental psychology. Could you give us a little précis of that book? I know that's probably a tough question to ask you, but yeah, what's that book
Well, given
about?
that there's probably about 120 pages of references in it, and
Right.
it's just, but yes, I think what I could say is that I really, really wanted to write a book which explained the important things about children's development, which has research behind it as well, but has but from a place of having a clinical mind. And I think most child development and developmental psychology textbooks are written by academics and they're not written by clinicians. And so I really wanted to think about or put into it, but slightly hide. I wanted it to be therapeutically relevant, but that particular book hasn't got many therapeutic stories in it, for example, whereas my later stuff is nearly all about using clinical examples. So, for example, there's a chapter on prenatal life, there's a chapter on the extraordinary things that infants can do, and then you see how defenses develop and the early research about how defenses develop, mismatches and repairs, ruptures, that kind of thing, coping strategies. And so all of these things I hope are relevant to every person we work with. It moves on to think about attachment theory and some of the overriding bodies of ideas, neuroscience and things like culture runs as a thread throughout it in terms of cultural difference. And I felt that was really, really important because there's so much stuff around about this is the right way to do things, this is what children need. And actually, we have to be much more humble than that. And I found the best way of trying to convey that is by saying that this people in this part of, I don't know, this particular Inuit group do this with their children and they think and believe this. And it's very different in Japan, and it's very different where we are. And it was very different in the UK 50 years ago. And that, so we need to be a little bit, I suppose, modest about the massive claims that are often made. And most psychology research is done on weird societies, Western, whatever, Western
Oh.
educated, industrial, whatever, rich, democratic so-called societies. And so, in fact, a disproportionate number of research is done about American university students, and that doesn't really give us a good enough basis for understanding this stuff. So I wanted to think about middle childhood and some of the interesting things, and about when I was writing it, actually, the first edition, we only just were learning that adolescent brain was developing the way it was, and that brain is still developing till about 25 or 26. So a lot of the stuff was pretty new. I called it Nurturing Natures because epigenetics was just becoming a thing that people had begun to think about. This was 2008, 2009. And so I wanted it to be, so there's a chapter on genes and epigenetics. And I felt that I wanted people to know that genes don't rule everything, because it was a time of the Human Genome Project and everybody, there's so much stuff about this is going to change everything. It hasn't changed that much, actually. And so this stuff about long-term effects of early experiences and the effects of a separate chapter on, so chapters on neglect and trauma. And I hope it's relevant to clinicians as a primer. It's a big thing, and it's probably not a thing you read in all in one go, but helpful for clinicians who want to make some sense of how people might have become the people they are.
Did you find that in the 10 or 14 years between publications that there was, I mean, there must have been a lot that's happened in that time that needed updating in the most recent edition, or?
Well, I think every single reference has been updated in the
Ah.
recent edition, and that's a lot of referencing. But so I don't think I've got a fourth edition in me, but I'm looking for volunteers when the time comes to help. But because it's a real lot of work. The second edition, we put in a chapter about altruism and moral development, quite influenced by, I wrote this book called The Good Life, which is how I met Paul, actually, and it's probably the thing that links me up with compassion-focused therapy originally. And so that was a whole new chapter. But this one, a lot, the world is changing so fast. I always thought I was reasonably ahead of the game, but current thinking on things like gender, on race and ethnicity, on a whole range of different things has meant that things really have had to be reframed quite dramatically in order to be palatable to young people today.
Yeah. Your other recent book, 22, I think it was, is Respark, Igniting Hope and Joy After Trauma and Depression. And actually I loved the very moving more the stories, the anecdotes and the clinical stories that are in that particular book. And I wondered whether we could sort of go through kind of three things with that. What is Spark? What is de-sparking and what is re-sparking, I guess. But so what is spark?
Well, it's just a slightly cheeky metaphor, really. It's nothing very original. But and we talked about passion before, and I suppose the metaphor was, and I was thinking about it a lot around COVID, the metaphor was based around the idea of energy and the importance of energy and high and low energy being a very important thing to take account of in therapeutic work and in our lives. And we know, and the reasons, and so this goes back. So the first, probably the first public talk I ever gave was in, actually was in Bologna, where I'd love to go back, about neglect, long, long, long time ago, because I'd begun to realize that there are a bunch of kids that I worked with who weren't getting any attention. They probably weren't getting referred into services very much. They were often come from backgrounds of abject neglect. For example, some of the orphanage kids, like some of those original Ceausescu Romanian orphanages kids. And there was something very flat, deadened, bit numb about them. And it was quite hard to like them. It was quite hard to be interested in them. Something had shut down or never come alive in them. People didn't want to work with them. I would find myself feeling a bit bored in my work and realizing my body was going numb in response to their bodies. And I didn't have passion and interest and spark. As there was this group of people that I worked with that weren't getting a good, that had a really bad deal and then weren't getting a good deal later on. And actually, the question is whether they were unsparked or de-sparked. And Anne Alvarez had a great child psychotherapist had this great metaphor of undrawn children as opposed to withdrawn children, because in a way they've never been drawn into life. So to be drawn into a life, what you hope is that parents there with you, they're looking in your eyes, they're talking to you, they're smiling with you, interested in you, and something comes alive. If you don't have that, then you turn inwards and you don't have the hope. Your eyes might go dull, your skin might become pallid, you even will walk be walking to, it's a whole, there's literally less energy in the body. And that's quite a parlous state. It's not a state anybody wants to be with, but also it really challenges us in terms of how we do our clinical work, because empathy and attunement doesn't do it. Because if I attune with you and you're really flat and dead, then there's just two flat and dead people in the room. Any cognitive interpretations don't work. It just, you get two people stuck in their heads. Often these people are in their heads quite a lot, not always. And so somehow what we want to do is change the energetic field. If that's not a term I used in the book, but you want to kind of spark somebody back into life somehow. And that often requires quite a lot of effort and energy. And often we're looking for these tiny little hints of sparks, which you easily miss when you're with somebody who's very dull down, because then you become dull down. So these are the kind of clients that we never, none of us want to admit it, but we might be nodding in their presence if they're an adult, but actually be thinking about what we're going to have for dinner, because our minds haven't been able to stay present, because nobody has stayed present with their minds, and they're not present in themselves properly. If that makes sense. So there's a kind of embodied resonance and a psychic resonance that takes place between us. And so these are people who I would consider to be unsparked, never sparked, really. And I don't want to say there are people like this and people like that, because but we might think we all have a bit of this in our personalities. if you like, if you think about these things as a spectrum. And I think of neglect as a spectrum, really. So people who had early experience of a very avoidant attachment relationships, they might be very a bit more shut down and cut off and cold in terms of, it's interesting the metaphors we use, cold as opposed to hot, heat as opposed to, you know, so numb, paralyzed, freezing, those sorts of metaphors that we use to do with. And I think, so that was my thing. I wrote a paper about neglect of neglect many years ago, and I've done various versions of it. And then when I began to work with trauma, I realized there's a different kind of presentation that we see in people who have had serious trauma. They might not be unsparked. They might have had a degree of life before, but serious trauma, especially ongoing developmental trauma, like constantly being physically abused or sexually abused, what might give rise to a kind of a need to shut down as in a form of dissociative defense, which is an incredibly sensible defense. It's the kind of thing that since first wrote about it, Porges was has begun to think about in terms of the dorsal vagal response, I suppose. It's that kind of, it's a life-saving thing in the face of life threat by going still, quiet, hope you don't get seen, that kind of thing. And that requires a very different therapeutic approach to, it can look a bit similar, but it requires a very different therapeutic approach to people who are neglected. It requires we are very sensitive to triggers, and that those people need to, in a way, re-embody themselves, as opposed to, so with neglected people, like it, with a neglected kid, often I'd be sitting there feeling a bit sort of flat, I've gone hopeless, don't know what I'm going to do. And then I might see their little finger move, and then I might move my little finger, and we might get a little bit of activity going. And it's just getting some reciprocity going so that you're trying to move them up into another level. With people who've had experienced severe trauma, so they've become de-sparked, they've shut in and they've closed in, shut down. Because that's been in a very, very sensible survival mechanism. It feels dead, it feels can feel really unsafe to come into your body too quickly, if that makes sense. But if they stay out of their body, then they're not living a life of any richness. And so some of the work will be just very, very carefully watching for the ways in which they might re-embody themselves, come back into the room, bear to face some feelings, bear to begin to think about things. And then you can get more energetic with. So one of the things about energy is that it's really necessary. So in CFT, the I know that's a sign of superficial platitude, but in CFT you have the blue circle, of course, you have, you know, you have the drive system. You have excitement, pleasure, and that can get co-opted and get hijacked by screens, but nonetheless, it's really important for our life. These people, if you're neglected, it's never developed. And if you've gone into these shutdown states after trauma, there isn't any spark in life. And it feels very, very dangerous to come alive because coming alive, if you've been constantly sexually abused, say, that you don't want to come back into your body and look, be excited and let alone feel sexual, for example. So it has to be much, much, much more slow. But so what we're doing is watching for, I feel I'm doing in my clinical work, is watching for defenses, watching for ways in which, so I didn't use, so for years, I didn't like the psychoanalytic concept of defense because I felt it was slightly pejorative because who wants to be called defensive? Not me. I'm not defensive. But actually I find it quite useful now because I find that if I was to say to somebody, so how do you feel about the perpetrator or your mother or whatever, and they said, well, they couldn't handle it, or they had a hard childhood, or I've forgiven them now. You know that they're pushing down some feeling or pushing away some feeling that actually if they accessed, energy would come back into their being. So if they could be angry, furious, and then possibly sad and have grief and remorse or whatever, then a cycle of emotions. That all requires energy. So anger, for example, is something, and I've learned this from a form of therapy called ISTDP especially, but also from the old bodywork stuff, that anger is a powerful force that comes up and out. Now, of course, we all work with people who are too angry, but many of the people we work with don't know how to access that, and they have to push it back in constantly. And that pushes down their energy and kills off their life force, if you like. If you want to think about, Freud's concept of libido and living in the belief system sufficiently to feel that you're excited by life. So there's that. And I one of the models I use is the work that's done on the mitochondria by a guy called Robert Navio. I'm not sure if people know about him, who he's done extraordinary work on the mitochondria, which of course are always seen as the powerhouses of the cell, basis of energy in the body, the mitochondria, making ATP, giving us energy and life. And a lot of illness is linked with mitochondrial dysfunction and disease. And what Navio said in his extraordinary research is that actually what happens is that when mitochondria incidentally have got their own DNA, without mitochondria we'd have no, there'd be no life on Earth. They respire oxygen. They're extraordinary, underrated source of our life. And he says that when mitochondria sense danger, and there's mitochondria in every cell, they're organelles in every cell of our body, just that when they're sensors as well as energy makers, and when they sense danger, like a virus or bacteria or fungus or a toxin or a traumatic situation, they stop energy production, they stop communication between cells, and they close in and close down. And we're supposed to do that in danger. So if you get a rogue, whatever it is, kangaroos don't generally go rogue, do they? But if they did and came, or not many predators are left in Australia, but if one came at you, and you're supposed to go still and quiet, and then when it's gone away, you come back to life again. And that's what we've evolved to do, is you might play dead or whatever, and then you'll come back to life again. But if the trauma is constant, then you're stuck in these shutdown states. And that's a bit like, so Navio has talks about CDR1, cell danger response 1, 2, and 3. And depending on the extent of the trauma or the whatever it is, the toxin, the virus, and we can get stuck in these places, which he suggests is often what you see as well in other low energy states, like fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue syndrome or a bunch of illnesses. They're often, interestingly, states in which there's very, very low energy. And actually, a lot of psychiatric presentations, and I think I might have talked about this at the conference, a lot of psychiatric presentations are linked with low energy states. So they might look high energy, like ADHD or slightly manic states, but actually, if you measure their thyroid, for example, it's very low. So what we want is a healthy, good running system, a kind of an engine that purrs nicely, is might be one metaphor, as opposed to one that's juddering all the time, or that's completely shut down and you can't get it to turn on. So I'm not sure if that's explained enough. I might go on for hours about this stuff, but anyway, that's
Oh,
an idea about Spark. So
yeah, no, wonderful, and sort of fascinating. I do have so many questions in a way, but yeah, the spark is kind of energy, vitality, but also engagement, connection, or something, reciprocity, that sort of thing, I suppose. That and people who have experienced, especially neglect, especially from very early on, there's kind of, they're sort of unsparked. They've never experienced that, and there's something in attachment and the interaction there that creates the spark, perhaps early on, and so they're sort of unsparked, and their drive system, as you say, is kind of inactive almost. And but then on the other hand, people who've had more sort of, I guess, fear-based or perhaps even shame-based trauma, where it's not just that they've been neglected and kind of not had the love, it's that they've actually also been harmed by their attachment figure or their sort of supposed caregiver potentially. For them, it's a kind of a de-sparking process. Perhaps it was there and it just gets kind of compromised by this experience and knocked out sort of thing. And the importance for that one in the intervention is perhaps safeness or something like that. With someone who's unsparked, it might be a little bit more directly towards drive system. You know, they move their hand and you move their hand, and we're getting a little thing, and maybe then at some point they look at you and smile, and you're thinking, "Oh, we're getting some spark almost."
Yeah,
But for
exactly.
someone who's more had that fear or shame or abuse, it's more delicate. It's about cultivating the safeness first to kind of even
Absolutely.
go there.
Well, I think in a way it's always about cultivating the safeness, but I think you, in a way, you're cultivating in a slightly different way with people who are neglected. But yes, I've missed that out really, that actually it's connection and safeness that's always at the root of the shifts and changes to a healthier energetic state, I think. And you see it in a very, very embodied way. You know, having worked with kids for a long time, but it's exactly the same with adults, that if somebody's fearful, you just close in. We all do it. We close up our bodies. And you know, we present the hard parts of our bodies, and our soft heart isn't open. And so it's that kind of opening up from a place of safeness and connection. It's always that that gives rise to the kind of shifts that we want.
Yes, I know that in CFT we often think about going around the three circles in a kind of an anti-clockwise direction. So we might be in threat, which might be fight, flight, freeze, appease, or freeze, fawn. But rather than going straight to drive, we might want to try to help downregulate threat and move to the soothing affiliative system, where we can. The soothing affiliative system is kind of like a safe haven, or and then a secure base from which we can then go back out to the drive system, I guess. So there's that sort of anti-clockwise idea around
I
the
never
model.
realized that. It's really interesting. Makes sense. Yeah. So we're always shifting. So I mean, that I think
Yeah.
whatever model we're using, and the CFT, I think, is brilliant in that respect. We're always watching for these nuanced shifts from one state to another, and thinking about where is somebody. Well, is this state particularly very helpful for this person? If I'm completely in the blue state and I'm just driven towards pornography and gaming, then I might need a bit of help to slow down and move somewhere else. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. No, I really agree. And but the Respark book, I think, puts a really a lot of sort of richness to exactly those sort of processes, and kind of really fills out, I think, in some ways, the three circles model, or the work of Porges, or those sorts of things that it addresses. You've also got a section there on missparking,
Yeah.
which I think you were kind of alluding to there with the pornography and gaming, maybe, I don't know. But yeah,
Yeah,
what's the
or
missparking bit?
so I think one of the interesting things about so one of the my great heroes has always been Donald Winnicott, and he wrote a brilliant paper many, many years ago, probably in the 1940s, called Mind in Its Relation to the Psychosoma, in which he described a bunch of people who have had to overuse their minds because they retreated into their minds because they couldn't feel safe in their bodies because their attachment figures, he didn't use that term, but couldn't be with them and hold them and make them feel safe. And so if you're so it's a form of defense in which you move into your mind as a way of holding yourself together. And some people, I work with a lot of people who live in that place a lot. And so what you've got is you've got very hyperactive mind, and often these people are brilliant. And I sit in session and think, wow, what an amazing thought. That's so interesting. But what often I find is I've lost contact with my body. So it's like I've got this mind-body split in myself when I'm listening, and I'm all excited up here, but actually my stomach's probably tight and I'm not present. And I think what's happening is there's a kind of unhelpful energy. And there's a real terror of slowing down, because slowing down often gives rise to. So that's one version of a missparking way of
I
being.
see.
Another might be when you're addicted to, or some kind of ADHD type of presentations, or some kind of presentations where people are overly in the blue system in CFT, who are overly using screens or activity or working too hard or addicted to sex or whatever it might be. It's all in a way in the service of not feeling stuff. And so there's a lot of energy, but the energy is there because if I stop, oh my God, I have to feel my feelings. I don't know what my feelings are. I don't want to feel them, because when I did feel them, it was horrible. So often it's bringing people back slowly down to a place where they can be present with themselves, even if that gives rise to a place of deep sadness and grief. And sometimes anger and rage about what they didn't experience. in order to come to a place where there's more quietness and proper presence with themselves and with other people, actually. Because often you find that these, I mean, I know I can be like this myself sometimes. When you're with people who are too jumpy, it's not relaxing. It's not easy. And so I think that what we often see is these shifts to something slower, calmer, and more real, more true, and more embodied. And that changes everything. It changes how they are with themselves, and it changes how they are with other people.
Things like threat-based drive or insecure striving, those might be sort of examples of perhaps the source of some sort of missparking.
Yeah, I completely agree. And you know, of course, we can use all kinds of different languages to think about this. So I was quite taken by, many years ago, by, I think Sue Gerhardt introduced me to this, Cass's ideas about intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. And what we want is to live a life in which we're motivated by the things that we think are important, like relationships, vocation, you know, ideals, that kind of stuff. But what you find is that people who have had more mental health issues because they've had more trauma tend to be more likely to have extrinsic motivations. I want a big car, a nice house, I'm going to wear the latest label, all of those sorts of things. And it's that never satisfies. And so many kids in the care system that I've worked with, their primary initial statements are all about the watch or the trainers or that kind of stuff, and not about anything inside, because what's inside doesn't feel like it's something they really want to be with and know, because of the early trauma. And so that is exactly so, and so that we create these defenses, if you like, and exactly what you're saying, that kind of striving that you described, in the terms that CFT uses, as a way of not being with what might be very, very painful.
I suspect this is a tricky question, but you know, sort of on a practical basis, what sorts of, I mean, are there kind of strategies you recommend? Are there things that people might do to sort of recall some of their spark, or perhaps, you know, develop spark anew?
You probably won't like this, but I'm less of a strategy type of a therapist probably than maybe, you know, so I'm really appreciative of, for example, a lot of the methodologies that the CFT uses in terms of soothing rhythmic breathing, and in terms of, you know, any of these things really, in terms of the chair work, in terms of a lot, any of these methodologies can be really, really helpful to bring people back into life. I suppose I'm just a bit long in the tooth, and so I would tend to trust that I would see something that's a direction that we can go in the room without having the technique too firmly in my mind. And it's interesting, because I think compassion focused therapy has been primarily developed by psychologists who come from that place often, which is, this is a methodology, this is a technique, this is the form of therapy. And I've come from a place which has been much more non-directive, with that very, very scary Lady Rachel Pinney in the council flat, to psychoanalysis, which is much more like, let's wait and see what comes up and go with it. And so I feel more confident about doing that, but still using some of these other things. So for example, if somebody's very, very triggered and looks like they're going dissociated, or they're going into, or I say, so what did your dad do to you? And I can't think, my mind's gone foggy, I feel a bit sick. Then you would do something, and it would be a technique. I might get them to put their feet on the floor. I might get them to do a wall squat. I might get them to do something which brings them back into the room and in their body. So definitely. And then you try to regain the connection, and then possibly challenge pressure for feeding and challenge the defenses. But I think everybody has to find their own way. I'm a great believer in people finding what fits them as therapists. And the more experienced I get, the less I think I absolutely know, and the more I think that I can't be like anybody else, and nobody should be like anybody else. And it's interesting, over the years training people at Tavistock, I've seen trainees saying exactly what they think their other supervisors think they ought to be saying, or, and sometimes it's worse. Sometimes it's wearing the same clothes as their analyst, or that, and walking in the same way and smiling in the same way. And I think you've got to be yourself, because there's nothing like a real relationship as, and not the whole story, but as an essential aspect of whatever is curative in therapy, whatever form.
I actually like your answer very much, Graham. So that's I come from well, motivational interviewing is one of
Oh,
my
yes.
key aspects, and so that comes very much from a tradition of person-centered therapy and humanistic psychology, and also just the importance of the therapeutic relationship, I suppose, and what we are doing in the context of that therapeutic relationship, and perhaps re-sparking is a little bit of maybe begins there, maybe begins in that sort of interpersonal, somewhat attachment kind of context. Paul, of course, is very big on therapeutic relationship in CFT as well, and
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
absolutely the fundamental, not least to help people to reconnect with soothing affiliative system and to feel safe with the therapist and so on.
And
But
I tell
no,
you
that's
what,
a
I think it comes through in the people who practice CFT. And when I was at the conference last year with you guys, and I say you guys, I can't quite say us guys yet, because I have too much other stuff as well as CFT, but I feel like I'm part of you as well. That you're such an interesting and obviously you can't say it for everybody who does CFT, but interesting and human beings you want to relate to. And that I think is a good starting point, I think. And
Yes.
it's these sort of, I remember a patient many, many years ago that I wrote about. I can't remember where I wrote about her actually. Anyway, it's probably, I wrote about an amalgam, but I've seen it enough with patients who come from backgrounds of trauma and abuse and who are actually pretty horrible human beings in many ways. Do not, and I worked at the Portman Clinic linked to the Tavistock in forensic work for a long time, and people did think unthinkable things and were very nasty as well. And but when they began to get better, whatever that means, and soften and get interested in themselves and find a bit of self-compassion and feel a bit of the grief for the life that they didn't have and the life that they did have, and get a bit, something would soften and they became nicer people, interestingly. And sometimes the proof of that was in not in a measure, not in fear of compassion scale, which I never use, but it probably would show it, but it's when the reception says, gosh, she looks so different.
Yes.
And she
Yeah.
she's so much nicer when she comes in now. It's that kind of thing.
Yes. Yes. And no, I know what you mean. I sort of observe it too when someone comes along after having been coming for a while, and you suddenly think, I can see the spark now. It wasn't there before, but I can see it, I can feel it. There's a kind of a glow or energy, like you say. It's not easy to put into words, but yes, it's a sort of spine tingling moment, isn't it, when you notice that kind of a shift for people. And the CFT group, certainly there's a lot of spark in there, I must admit.
That
And
is for
we do
sure.
see you definitely as part of the gang. But
That's lovely.
well, thank you very much. Fascinating and very moving, I think. And I'll definitely put the links to Nurturing Natures and ReSpark in the description, but as well as perhaps some of your other books that you've alluded to as well. What's happening next for you, Graham, in terms of your any new projects on the go?
Apart from getting a bit older, still doing, I'm still got fairly full clinical practice, and I do a reasonable number of talks and supervision and training and that kind of thing. In terms of writing, having put Nurturing Natures to bed and it's now out in the world, I was thinking about doing a series of guides, but we'll see if it works. And maybe a series is a bit daunting, about using some of the research and thinking around of different developmental issues. So I'm starting with one on prenatal life and pregnancy, which is a bit, I feel slightly awkward about starting with that because I'm a man. But nonetheless, that's what I'm And it's completely fascinating and interesting. And so I'm getting near the end of that, and then we'll see where I'm not even sure where I'm going to put it yet and how it'll come out. But then there might be other ones of those. But I've also got other interests. So I'm very interested in stuff we've been talking about, really, interconnectivity, consciousness, other things to do with synchrony, and there's kind of subtle ways in which things connect, a bit like a mycorrhizal network of human beings together. So they're like bigger, slightly more philosophical things. Whether they'll ever become anything in writing, I don't know, but I've certainly got these guides as an idea.
Yeah. Well, I will be waiting with bated breath to see what comes next, and highly recommend your work so far. And if people, I think you have a website, don't you? So people can sort of get in, sort of connect with your stuff through that.
Yeah, definitely. I've got a website. I've got a website in which it's got all the publications listed as well, papers and journals and chapters and books, and also events, forthcoming events and other stuff. And also I have a newsletter which I publish once a month, which basically has things like things I've got a bit interested in, books I've read, events that are coming up of mine and other people's. Normally has a really bad joke or two in it, and possibly some research and photographs, and I'm probably putting everybody off. But anyway, it's easy to sign up to, so if I give you the link to sign up to that as well.
Yes, the link for that as well. And I think you're still on Twitter, aren't you?
Yeah, a bit less than I was, but I'm still there. Yeah,
Yeah,
so I
because
can still see.
you are one of the sort of, I guess, people on Twitter that kind of keeps me in there, actually. It's a bit of
Oh,
a
really?
rough old place at the moment, but you do also share very, very positive kind of content social media wise as well.
I try to not get drawn into any of the controversy. So I tend to use it very basically. So I tend to either put in a bit of news or mainly bits of research that I found interesting that other people
Yeah,
might find interesting. I do the same on
that's right.
LinkedIn, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that stuff's really great. I mean, there's so many things I would love to talk to you about, the defenses you mentioned, or the fears, blocks, and resistances, as Paul would say, and also the culture stuff that you alluded to early on. And
Yeah.
I'm also particularly interested in men and compassion and men and self-compassion at the moment, and that would be
Ah.
fascinating to talk to you about as well. But thank you, Graham, very much for being on Compassion in a T-shirt.
It's great to be here and fun to talk to you, Stan, and thanks very much for asking me.
Thank you.